And now, let's turn to Inside the City, a weekly chat with local officials, residents, and personalities providing up-to-date and relevant information about what's happening in your city of Palmer. Moderated by Mike Malevsky.
Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio, once again, Palmer's Police Chief, Lance Kerling. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Temperatures down at zero, I noticed early today. It seemed hard to believe because there was very little breeze, and I know that it's going to get warmer. In terms of the temperatures up and down effect on the police department, what?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. Anytime you have, and fortunately for the roads, it's largely stayed below freaving, and we don't get that freeze-thaw cycle that makes them into such ice rinks that we sometimes get during breakup or those unique periods and during the course of the winter when it warms up to 40 degrees and then everything melts and then refreezes. But the challenge for police officers is staying warm for potentially extended periods outside, depending on what they're doing, if they're conducting an investigation or sitting on a perimeter or active or inactive. Going from indoors to outdoors quickly can pose a lot of challenges. And something as simple as, you know, if you wear glasses, keeping those from fogging up. If you've been outside for a period of time and then have to go into a building to clear it can become real issues. So, yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. Traction and is another issue. You know, do you want to wear your ice cleats or ice spikes? Because they work great outside, but as soon as you step on a floor that's laminate or tile, you skid around like you're on ice skates. So, yeah, these are all things that they just learn to adapt and cope with.
Yeah, it's hard to... I'm just thinking about that because I've been in circumstances where I've had to go in and out. And as long as you can be outside, you know, I'm going to be outside for a lengthy period of time.
Sure.
I get my gear on, certain conditions. But you're pointing to variable circumstances in a vehicle, out of a vehicle, in a building, out of a building, mm-hmm. et cetera. Yes.
Yeah, sure. How do you keep that optic on your rifle from fogging up if you're going in or out? Or like I said, something as simple as your eyeglasses. If you're dressed for outside and you need to go indoors to say there's an alarm, and usually they turn out to be false the vast majority of the time they do. But say you have to go check out the high school.
Sure.
And, you know, you've been outside for a long period of time and wearing your heavy gear. Well, clearing the high school can take quite a bit of time. And if you're wearing all that heavy stuff, that starts to weigh you down pretty quickly and overheat, and then you have a heat problem. So it's just an interesting set of circumstances.
Okay. Learn to adapt. Yeah. Well, speaking about learning to adapt, we'd spoken briefly before you're coming in about a change in the bail system. Which has left some people scratching their heads. And there's been a phrase, no bail, that's been applied to this, but it really isn't no bail. It does change things.
It does indeed, yeah. There was a new statewide bail schedule published on December 8th, it's in effect here in the 3rd Judicial District as well. But, there's an important distinction to be made between no bail and an own recognizance release, which is what a lot of misdemeanors are right now. There are some misdemeanors where there is a monetary bail set, things like a second or subsequent DUI, a physical assault against a person that is not DV in nature. DV in nature, then they are held for what is typically a true no bail. In other words, they are held pending arraignments the next day when there will be a formal reading of a charges and a judicial officer will set bail at that time. But they are held until that arraignment. So, which is not to be confused with own recognizance, which is in fact a sort of bail. So you pick up somebody for, let's say, theft, small amount of theft. It's a misdemeanor crime, and they're booked into MATSU pretrial. They are, according to the statewide bail schedule, released on their own recognizance with certain conditions. They need to make all their court dates. They need to obey all laws. They need to communicate with appropriate attorneys. There may be a no alcohol prohibition in it, but there are these conditions that are set that are part of the bail. They just don't have to pay a monetary amount. And so that can sometimes be confused with no bail, but in fact, it is a bail. It's an own recognizance release, whereas in no bail, they are held until arraignments the following day or later that day if they're arrested early in the morning.
So I saw one report that suggested that an individual found himself not to be, he didn't follow the steps. And that led me to think about, okay, if it's a fairly extensive set of steps, who assists, encourages, where it I mean,
when you say the steps, do you mean the steps in the process?
Once the person is out and it's incumbent mm-hmm. upon them to be proactive and do certain things. In other words, they're not going to be contacted so that they're the passive recipient of attention, but they are they're out there and in one case, and I'm searching my memory here, I seem to remember there was a PED a need to contact someone, and the individual didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, well, I didn't know. I didn't know what that was. In the moment of being told, he said, uh-huh. But as he followed on down, the reality of actually doing something, which is a new process involving a action by someone who is in this situation. In other words, is that a change here?
No, not really. And I think I follow what you're saying. But in general, when there are conditions of release set, no contact with the victim, you know, must enroll in X, Y, or Z, something right. along those lines, those are always very clearly spelled out on paperwork that's given to defendants at their release, or if it's set at a court date, at the actual court date. And they get copies of that in writing about what it is they're supposed to do.
Right.
Now, could there conceivably be an occasion where somebody is handed a large sheaf of paperwork and perhaps doesn't understand precisely what it is they're supposed to be doing. Sure, I suppose that could happen. It's incumbent upon the individual involved in the circumstances, though, to make sure that he does understand. And this is also one of the reasons why legal representation is there, is because attorneys live for this kind of thing, and they understand the ins and outs of these steps, like you call them, or these requirements of bail or conditions of release very, very well. Mm-hmm. So, and that might involve pretrial monitoring. You know, you have to check in with pretrial monitoring services every so often, or, you know, in the event of a no alcohol condition of release, you have to submit, you know, breath tests, which can be done, you know, electronically through something. You might have to be on an ankle monitor, house arrest, those types of things. And those are all very clearly spelled out in the paperwork, so people do understand. So,
yeah, I'll leave this in a moment, but what I was thinking here, as I've been reviewing the description of the change, is that there seems to be, and it's just my impression, more being placed upon the individual to be proactive in this activity and not under the care or being watched over or nudged, if you will, mm-hmm. by someone who is following his or her case. And I don't know whether that's accurate in the changes that have occurred or whether it's always been that way, because we come across people who have failed to comply with.
Sure. And that was, you know, the time when typically your warrants will come out for their arrest, okay. which interestingly enough carry their own bail. You know, somebody failed to make an arraignment date. Somebody failed to show for a change of plea hearing. Usually they missed a court date of some sort, and right. there's a warrant issued for their arrest. Maybe they even absconded from the state or something along those lines, and so a warrant will be issued for them. What I can say is that since December 8th, we have not noticed, at least in Palmer,
okay.
a significant increase in the kind of things that you're talking about.
Okay. So, good. That's really probably where I should leave that. Let's move on to another aspect of police work that involves something that I am told in Alaska has a heavy incident rate, and that's domestic violence.
Sure.
So officers very often, it seems, will encounter situations that have one or another degree of domestic violence. How are officers prepared to deal with that and maybe talk about the incidents in the area.
Well, domestic violence rates varies, of course, from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. To give you a local example, Palmer had 97 separate assaults that we investigated last year, plus a significant number of criminal mischiefs. In other words, somebody damages somebody else's property. Of those myriad of cases, between 30 and 40 of them were domestic violence in nature, whether the assaults or the criminal mischief. And either one of those can be a domestic violence offense. In other words, if you damage the property of a domestic partner or somebody that would qualify under the domestic violence laws. And that is, in fact, a domestic violence offense. We are required to make an arrest if we determine probable cause. There's very little leeway given to us in that regard. Misdemeanors, which are domestic violence in nature, are also one of those offenses where officers are allowed to make, and in fact required sometimes, to make an arrest on an offense they did not witness up to 12 hours after the time of the offense. In other words, so you have probable cause to believe that there was a misdemeanor domestic violence assault, the ubiquitous one spouse punches another, there's a black eye. You've determined that there's probable cause to believe that the spouse that you can't currently find has committed this offense. If you locate them within 12 hours, you will make an arrest, even though you did not witness the offense. And that's a result of some very what would be viewed as pretty stringent DV laws that came down from the federal government and are now in Title 18 of the Alaska statutes.
Okay. So a domestic violence situation, is an officer approaching that has been, I'm guessing, the recipient of considerable training or experience or...
Both, usually. Yeah, there's separate blocks of instructions involving domestic violence in the academy. There's ongoing training at the departmental level for domestic violence training. There are some a myriad of different things that affect a domestic violence assault or a domestic violence criminal mischief case as compared to one that is non-domestic violence in nature. The standards, the culpable mental state, the elements of the crime are all the same. It's just, do we have that domestic violence relationship involved in this case here? And if we do, then we need to take certain other steps.
Okay. So from time to time in the past when you've come in, we've talked about technology, and I seem to remember seeing a brief mention of drones. Was the Anchorage Police Department looking at a drone for some of its work?
Yep.
And would you comment about drones and or whether the Palmer Police Department sees a possible use of a drone for one thing or another?
Sure. Drones are first and foremost a political decision that needs to be made by the elected officials of whichever organization or jurisdiction might be using them, because it's a really hot button topic. Are they an extremely effective tool for potentially gathering evidence, locating individuals? They absolutely are. Is there potential for abuse with drones? Are there some privacy concerns with drones that relate to the Alaska Constitution? Well, there certainly are those as well. And you're going to find people on both sides of the issue, especially at a time right now when people are so fed up with criminal activity. The reality is, though, creating a drone policy is something that can't be done overnight. And as a matter of fact, there's some Alaska standards for how a department would have to go about doing that. There has to be a public comment period. There has to be discussion with the legislative body. There have to, if a drone program is in place and drones are going to be used, there's a requirement that the department notify the local area that they are going to be flying a drone. There's quite a bit of this out there right now. And as a result, you see a great many departments that have just not done anything yet because they're trying to figure out the lay of the land.
Right.
So who can be certified to fly the drone? What can the drone be used for? Does it need a warrant in order to fly and operate the drone? Or is it something that you could use under the plain view doctrine of the search warrant exceptions? So what kind of training would be involved? There's a lot of different things that come up with drones, which are interesting. And as a result, we're still, again, from a criminal investigative or a search and rescue standpoint or that sort of thing, they have the potential to be extremely useful. However, extreme caution and circumspection is called for in these kinds of situations, because it has the opportunity to do so much that's outside the scope of what's intended for these things. And our mission is to protect people's rights first and foremost, not violate them. So if we have a drone, and we don't at this point, so let me just be clear about that. We're not operating drones. We don't have a drone policy or procedure. But if we were to adopt such a thing, it would have to be with extremely tight controls over it.
Okay. So this is an interesting thing, because what I'm thinking is that we have drones, which are a mobile camera system, among other things. But then we also have fixed video cameras. With the proliferation of a variety of movie scenarios and others that were, it seems in some locations there are cameras on every corner and at every building.
Sure.
The reality in Palmer is that's not the case.
In fact, it's not. No. Yeah. So, and there's a lot of different reasons for that. One is cultural. You know, if you go to places specifically in Europe, you know, London immediately comes to mind, or some of the larger metropolitan areas, there's CCTV everywhere. And they've come to accept that as a standard that they're willing to have. Alaska, in particular, has a clearly written right to privacy in its constitution. Also clearly defined is that there is no expectation of privacy when you're talking to a police officer. As a result, on our cars or on our persons with our body cams or our vehicle cams, there's not a problem with recording most of the stuff that we come in contact with. A drone, that's a different story, because a lot of people might not even know it's there. And it's being operated by a law enforcement agency, you know, in the case of a police drone. And so it's the government doing this, and the government is now able to access locations that they never were able to access before. So a rough parallel can be drawn between this and kind of the Kylo decision that came up with thermal imagers a while back. So a thermal imager, or a FLIR, is something that sees heat for all intents and purposes.
Right.
And departments across the country thought, hey, these are great for spotting things like marijuana grow operations that give off a lot of heat. So you point it at a house and it shows whether the roof is hot, where it's coming out through windows, that kind of stuff. But that's all it does. It can't see through a window. And there were some industrial uses for it as well. On a large building where insulation is an issue, does this thing see heat escaping, and can you beef up your insulation? Long story short, the courts determined that basically the use of the FLIR, because of the relative newness of the technology, the fact that it wasn't commonly employed in everyday use, would require a search warrant, or it could be used in exigent circumstances in order to help locate somebody that was, maybe in a search and rescue operation.
Sure.
But what you could not do, and still cannot do, is pointed at a residence with the intent of gathering criminal evidence in some type of case. And drones might very well fall under that same thing. You know, could there be an exigent circumstances where you need this drone because you're trying to locate a lost kiddo in the woods? And that's going to be much more useful than maybe just dragging through the woods with a few people online. That's a different set of circumstances than if you're using this drone to try to develop criminal information for a case that could only be obtained by the drone or some type of aircraft. And there haven't been a great many decisions on this from the court so far. So you have to kind of go back to what the Constitution says, and our state Constitution says people have a right to privacy.
So you've made the distinction about a law enforcement agency or the government doing this, but individuals, say, if you have a business and you choose to have a webcam,
sure,
but whether inside or outside your building, that's of course something that you can do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And for what it's worth, if the city elected to put up cameras around City Hall for security reasons or something,
sure,
along those lines, which they don't have yet, but they certainly could if they wanted to, there would be no problem with that. So if it's a public area, it's a difference than if it's a private area. In other words, you know, the department wants to conduct surveillance on a particular house. Can you just plop a camera up on the tree across the street without their knowing it that points at that house? And, well, you know, it depends on the circumstances. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. But, it's different than if you put up a camera to monitor, say, the shooting range.
sure.
out at Maude Road, which is public use, public access, or something like that, than if you would put up a camera and point it at someone's bedroom window, you know, if you're the government. So,
very different
circumstances. Yeah, very great different set of circumstances. And so for civilian use in drones, whether it's private or corporate or whatever, that's generally covered by FAA regulations. And there's a myriad of those, you know, are a little tedious to get into at the moment. But suffice it to say that they're not covered by the same restrictions as the government is.
Okay. Well, one other topic I'd like to check in on, because it seems to be a changing circumstance, has to do with marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
So what we have in the state of Alaska right now is an ongoing, development of a, wholesale and retail, production of marijuana. Laws have seemingly allowed individuals to possess marijuana in certain quantities, et cetera. City of Palmer has not chosen to allow that, retail and wholesale production, but given what is happening in surrounding areas, has that had any impact upon Palmer from the standpoint of working with people who are using marijuana legally? Or
yes, but it's a matter of degrees rather than a huge exponential shift, which, you know, some people expected. Marijuana has been prevalent in the state for a long period of time before legalization took place in 2014. And as a result, use was always fairly heavy. What I would say is that anecdotally, we're seeing an increase in suspensions and expulsions from school due to marijuana use. And then we certainly are running across individuals that are legally using marijuana in their home. You might tend to smell it more if you're going into a house for a disturbance or something like that than ones we had, because it is a legal substance in the state as far as state law is concerned. And so, yes, but in terms of Palmer, seeing massive bales of marijuana coming through in vans or something along those lines, we're just not seeing it right now. So, or if we are, we haven't caught it, which is a fair thing to say too. We don't catch everything that goes through town, but it's not been a massive increase in marijuana coming into the community.
Okay. Mike Malewski, and I've been talking with Palmer Police Chief Lance Ketterling. Chief, any other topics that you would like to in particular emphasize before we finish up today?
No, I don't think so. Just enjoy your weekend. Be safe.
Right. And that's a good thing. It's going to be a little bit warmer this weekend, but if you're going up in the mountains in particular, be very careful.
Avalanche aware. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. You've been listening to Inside the City, a weekly chat with local folks providing up-to-date and relevant information about what's happening in your city of Palmer. Moderated by Mike Malewski. This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters. If you have any comments or questions, please email manager@radiofreepalmer.org.